The following talk, entitled The Cosmological Aspects of Consciousness by Will Ross and Emily Sellin, is presented by the Theosophical Society in America.
When this topic was first assigned to me, I don't know about Will, because I'm easily flummoxed and nobody can flummox Will. So he probably didn't have the same reaction. But in the beginning, I thought, oh, well, that's easy to talk about consciousness. Consciousness, we all have consciousness. We can certainly talk about something which we all experience. And then I began to realize that it's comparatively easy to talk about aspects of consciousness. But to talk about consciousness itself is a little bit like Simple Simon trying to catch the ocean in a bucket. Or maybe even worse, it's like trying to capture a cloud in a net. You can't, it's everywhere, and therefore you don't catch it. It's like the air we breathe and the water that's around us. We experience it, but it's very difficult for us to identify it, to know it in any more than that immediate sense. I know that because I'd once tried to write an article on water, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, even although we all can't do without it. And so, since consciousness is so pervasive, so elusive, so ever-present, so subtle, it's obvious that anything that one says is going to be so partial, so indirect, that it's almost impossible to have a discourse which is misleading. Therefore, what Will and I decided to do is that we're not going to talk about consciousness, we're going to have a conversation about it. We're going to throw a few ideas at each other, which we'll perhaps take up and sling back or throw away or whatever we like to do with them. And perhaps in the course of this conversation, some of the immensity and the reality of what consciousness is, its immediacy, its presence, may make itself felt amongst us here. And Will wanted me especially to say in the beginning, if anybody else wants to take up that idea, clutch it in their hand and fling it in the air, do so. Feel free. So I'm going to begin, perhaps, by asking Will or posing a problem to Will, because it's one that I think is one of the most fundamental with respect to consciousness, and that is, how does consciousness relate itself to mind?
Just before I talk about that particular question, Emily, I'd like to read the quotation which I used at Pumpkin Hollow, which I think in many ways expresses something about the subject that we're talking about, but also to me represents the real reason for coming together in events such as this. I found it in an unsigned article in a magazine, and it reads as follows. The metaphysical thinker is always on his own. Like the artist or poet, he has to find his own way and all the way by acts of self-reference, with only insight and reason to guide him. He can find no confirming reference in corporate truth. Only the test of life's experiences will tell him or how close he may have come to the way things really are. But meanwhile, there is companionship in the resonance of other metaphysical thinking. This sense that there is resonance in the companionship of other metaphysical thinking, this is the thing that I think always comes out when a body of theosophical students are gathered together and are trying to understand these things. But particularly when we are speaking of consciousness, we are speaking of things which, in a certain sense, are always beyond definition. It is always something which lies behind us. And even in the endeavor to understand consciousness, we constantly find ourselves confused by the difference between consciousness and the contents of our consciousness. I think the theosophical idea with regard to man and cosmos is that we are rooted in the real, the non-material real, if you want. All of you who remember Fritz will remember how often he emphasized that particular point. And it's something that we can never forget. And the real is undefinable. The real is something beyond speculation. Yet, of course, we spend an infinite time speculating about it. But it's that which lies at the very root of everything. Now, this certain aspects of this real manifest itself through all the fields of nature that lie between that reality and this physical body, this physical world of which we are all so aware. And in all those fields, man becomes aware of himself. That is, he becomes conscious of himself in various places, various locations, if you like, although location is not a very good word, various levels of those fields. Consciousness is always, as it were, the manifestation of a localization in the field. And this is where the necessity for man's careful examination of the way in which always he surrounds himself by the contents of his consciousness. In other words, we are looking at the world and we learn a little about it. We meet with people, we meet with other thinkers. We gradually absorb a culture, a whole concept, and this surrounds us like a web. We surround ourselves more than anything else with a web of words which somehow bind us to a certain restriction so that we lose sight of consciousness and are aware only of this cocoon which is self-made, which is part of our endeavor to experience the world. Now, what is needed to break down that cocoon and for us to realize ourselves is that we shall look at it and become aware of it, and gradually, by efforts of will and insight and thought, gradually dissolve that cocoon so that our consciousness, as it were, moves forward and immediately starts the same process over again. It's a never-ending process. This is, in one way, both the paradoxical nature of it and yet the beauty of it, that always we are making ourselves. The path to the future is not something which is given, but something which is made. The Voice of the Silence emphasizes this so strongly. And John Shear, in a quotation of which I've become very fond of late, says exactly the same thing. That the future is not some place we are going, but one we are creating. The paths to it are not given, but made. And the making changes both the maker and the destination. Now, in this process, of course, we are aided by insight, by our endeavor to still our minds, if you will, and look to the source of all intelligence. We have an insight, but that insight is just like raising the curtain on the drama. After the insight comes all the mechanics of the play of our life, of our experience, of all that we do. And it is the mind which writes the play. And this, of course, is what we have to do. It is a tremendous, rigorous, almost stupendous task. It's not always, what shall I say, a pleasant way, although if one is devoted to it, it's more fun than anything else in the world. But I am always reminded of that statement which you will find in one of Jacob Needleman's books when he was speaking to some thinker, one of the old rabbis, who said to him, "God is not nice. God is an earthquake." And I think this is a very true statement. Theosophy isn't nice. Theosophy is an earthquake. It stirs us up. If you read the letters of the masters, they're telling you when you tread this path, you're in jeopardy. You are not on a pleasant journey in the ordinary sense of that word. You're on the only journey that matters. But I think it is this tremendous struggle to know, to understand, to break down the cocoons which the content of our consciousness have created round about us, that enables us to go on and grasp consciousness at another stage. In other words, in order to know consciousness, you must always be looking to the next stage of consciousness, not looking where you are now. Does that begin to answer what we were talking about, Emily?
Well, I'm a heretic, you know. And so I'm going to give it a challenge immediately. A phrase that you use, which is, I know, traditional in Indian philosophy. But nevertheless, I don't accept it. And that is that consciousness had contents. This word I really dislike, because to me it has a very mechanistic and materialistic connotation. That it's as though consciousness is a box and it has some contents. And you can take those contents out and you put other contents in without affecting consciousness itself. I don't think of consciousness that way. I think of consciousness as the ground in terms of which all things, events, creatures, processes present themselves. And if we think of consciousness in those terms, then we understand that no matter in what guise consciousness presents itself, it's always there, indefinable, but always the eternally existent. That which is always there, which always presents itself. And if we are going to understand the creative nature of the power, so to say, the creative power of intelligence, then we have to understand what it is that is presenting itself. Now, I'm going to get metaphysical just for a second, I promise. It won't, you know, I'll rush by as fast as possible, but just for a second. And now I'm going to be even more heretical because I'm going to quarrel with HBB. You know, nobody dares do that. But you can do it because HBB is always contradicting herself and putting it in different ways anyway. So I'm going to quarrel with one of her statements. She characterizes the metaphysical triad, that is the absolute triad, if we want to call it, the triplicity which it evidences itself in the world, the way the world is created, the creative principle, if you'd like to call it that, as the absolute one and spirit and matter. But you can't do that because the absolute one cannot be part of any triad. How can it? It's the absolute one. Impossible. She shouldn't have done that. That was a slip. That's mixing non-being and being. You can't do that. There are two irreducible orders that you can't. Now, you can quarrel with me later. I know you will. All right. I'll give you a chance in a minute. But I think it would be more consistent to leave the one as it always is one, and while the root and source of everything else, the one is one, 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 one. Therefore, it's two, three, four, seven, nine, whatever you like. It's the beginning of that sequence. But always remaining itself one. and see the metaphysical triad as the primary differentiation within the one, which is spirit or consciousness and matter and energy. It is only consciousness objectifying itself as the world. And if we understand that those two, spirit and matter, are absolutely always, inevitably, co-equal and associated with one another and never, never exist in the world separate, then we understand that the world is not dual. Then we understand it's a unitary. It is one. It is whole, always. There is inwardness and outwardness, two aspects of consciousness. You may say the self as it presents itself in the world. And it, the interaction, the relationship between self and other, or self seeing itself as not out there, but here, because this is the birth of space, this is the birth of time, this is the birth of process. That relationship, that play, is the creative power of intelligent life, if you can call it that way. That is life. Then the third term in that metaphysical triad is life, mahat, if you like to put it that way, mind, the creative power of intelligence in the world, which is formative, which is world-giving, which is creative, which produces everything out there. But it is only a relationship. Now, I've said enough, maybe, at that point. you can contradict me.
Yeah, of course.
I'll give you a chance.
I've often quarreled with HPB, too. I've said on many occasions, regard to the statement of the third fundamental principle, that I'm not at all happy about it, but then this is as it is. And of course, I agree with you with a tremendous difficulty in this designation of the one. I think Temley puts it rather well somewhere, where he puts that the absolute is the void and should be always symbolized by zero. And that it is only when then we speak of dualities, which are things that we all can speak about very easily. And between zero and duality, there is, of course, necessary to put another number, which is one. So this oneness is always something which, and of course, is traditionally in so many religious systems, used both as the absolute, which I feel is wrong, and as life itself, which is perhaps an aspect of that zero-ness, and which is therefore something which partakes in the Trinitarian concept of things. Now, with regard to the content of consciousness, I admit, like all similes, it has its great difficulties, because it's just like it's an anthropomorphizing process where we tend to look at it in a very formal way. I quite agree with you that consciousness is a moving, dynamic, vital part of ourselves, that which is constantly thrusting towards complete understanding. But that thrust in our, which results in our egoism in a way, does cause us to create around ourselves a cocoon, a web, so that we lose sight of the reality. I think it's Eliade who said somewhere that the cause of sorrow of the human condition is metaphysical ignorance. And I agree, of course, that ignorance is always the cause of our failure to see these things as they are. We're told the world is an illusion, and most of us sort of hang on to that idea. But of course, the real problem is that we are deluded into thinking that that illusion is the reality. And the progress of our consciousness is a constant urge towards that understanding of the reality that lies behind. Now this, of course, this reality, from my point of view at any rate, is always imminent in experience. It's not discovered by intellectual analysis. It's discovered in experience. But in experiencing, we tend always to get fixed, static, to mirror the external world, to follow the ideas of other thinkers instead of discovering our own, something which Emily and I are perhaps less guilty of than most people. So it is in this way that I think that we must look at it. And of course, I think always we must recognize that consciousness tends to be a concomitant of time, that always to consciousness a section of the world comes to life as a floating image constantly changing in time. This, I believe, is the way we look at it. It's constantly changing in time. And that if you get out of time, you're unconscious, which, again, is one of the problems that confront many of us, where we're looking for a timeless world. We forget that if you are looking for a timeless world, you're looking for an unconscious world. And this is part and parcel of the way I think we have to look at it.
I just have got a nice little quote from Schrödinger that I have to throw at you now because it seems to me very apropos. He says, consciousness is a phenomenon in the zone of evolution. The world then increasingly becomes conscious, and this is what Will is pointing to when he talks about the notion of time as consciousness being involved with time. But we understand that time is only motion in space, that's all it is. And therefore it's because consciousness is moving all the time that we have the illusion of time. But that actually, the here and now, which is, shall we say, eternal time and eternal space, are the here and the now. The here being our relationship with space, the now being our relationship with time, or what undergirds time. We understand that we are only conscious, really, in the here and now, at the moment to moment. This is when consciousness reveals itself, now, here and now. And that's why, of course, it is so creative. Because the world presents itself to us here and now. And all else is but a memory, a dream, an imagination of what might have been or what was in our interpretation, because it's not reality that we see. So that we have to understand that it's the inwardness and the outwardness of consciousness. It's the inwardness reflecting itself in the outwardness that is the creative movement of consciousness in the here and now, because this is when we create. This is our opportunity. This is the opportunity of consciousness to create the world. Now, it's now that action is implied in the movement of consciousness. And of course, when we talk about movement, this implies consciousness. I know I'm throwing an awful lot of ideas at you all at once, big, like throwing out confetti. and I don't want to mix you up completely. But at the same time, it's only in that burst of insight, which every great teacher has talked about, that takes place, at that we begin to apprehend the nature of what the real might be. And since consciousness, and if I may talk for a minute about one of my pets,
It's the idea that consciousness is formative. We can say it's creative, but we have to understand that it is formative. It creates the world. It creates the forms which constitute the world. It is the architect, if you might call it that, of the universe, but it is not only the architect, it is the artist, the musician, the creative impulse, which it is in all of nature. And, you know, people talk about altered aspects of consciousness. I often wonder, altered states of consciousness, if we only understood that if we look at a tree, at a rock, at a flower, that's the altered state of consciousness presenting itself to us, which we don't apprehend as such. If we can go back to, as phenomenologists say, to the things, oh, I don't think that's their implication, I'm reading it into it, back to the things as they are in themselves, we then would understand the nature of consciousness as it reveals itself, as it presents itself in the world. Because I go back and back to that word presence. It is a presence. It's in the present, and it is a presence, and it presents itself to the world. In that same sense, if I may say so, we, because we as human beings have achieved, of a new transcendence, as Dobzhansky would say, in evolution, in the movement of consciousness, to the point of self-reflection. Jung says, in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, through consciousness, man takes possession of nature by recognizing the existence of the world, and thus, as it were, confirming the Creator. The world becomes the phenomenal world, for without conscious reflection, it would not be. And this is the truth. The world would not be without this power of consciousness. Therefore, what does this imply for us? In the most literal sense, we are self-created and self-creating. From moment to moment, we are what we will to be, what our intention is to be, what our thought is, what our image, all those aspects of consciousness create us as we are from moment to moment. We are truly self-created. And if I'm sick, it is I who have made myself sick. And if I'm sad, it's I who makes myself sad. And if I am enlightened, it's I who have enlightened myself. Is it not so? So that therefore, our opportunity as creative consciousnesses, as creative beings, are infinite, infinite.
Yes, of course, I quite agree with you, because the imminence of experience is the thing which relates us or makes us aware of, is perhaps it's not really a relationship because it's an actuality. It makes us aware of what we are, of our own consciousness. This, of course, was something which the Buddha spoke of 2,500 years ago, and which some of our philosophers like Hartshorne are beginning to point out today, that in one sense the only reality is immediate experience, immediate, now, because that is the only reality that we have, that if we are totally involved, I think is perhaps the best way, totally devoted to being aware at the moment, then in that moment we, as it were, bring forth all our past into that moment and add something new, which is the integrating experience of that moment, which therefore is the only reality. And therefore, in a very real sense, to live from moment to moment is the only way of expressing our own consciousness. Now, what Emily says, of course, about our own creative powers is exactly the thing which shows man's participation in the cosmos. If there is one power which our consciousness has, it is the power of the total consciousness which is in everything. The fields, the trees and things, and all the minerals, everything is conscious. We have a particular localized self-awareness of that, but we are able to contact all these things because of this consciousness which runs through everything. And man partakes of the creative aspect of this consciousness. That is what he is doing. As Madame Blavatsky says, you know, in the summing up, man should be ever striving to be a co-worker with nature in the cyclic task. This is what co-worker means, co-creating this world. And unless we live that kind of creative life, we are losing the sense of our identity with all life. It's one of the great paradoxes, and of course, I always say that if you don't think these things are paradoxes, you don't really know what you're talking about. That the great paradox of things is that as you become aware of yourself, you become aware of the whole of nature everywhere. You realize that your personal consciousness is somehow part of a planetary consciousness. I like using the two P's merely for their alliterative effect rather than for anything else. And I think this is what we have to realize, that it is our making ourselves. And this is why I think that we must be aware of the way in which we cocoon ourselves, the way in which we do wrap ourselves up from being aware of our own nature, that we have fixed patterns of thought, of feeling, what is usually summed up in the word conditioning. We are conditioned by all the experiences of life, and we allow that conditioning to entirely cover, veil the consciousness that lies behind. And our constant effort is to break out of that and to see beyond the conditioned aspect into that which lies behind. In this way, we begin to realize something of the whole order of the universe. In 1973, Werner Heisenberg said that mind or matter is a consequence of mathematical structure. That, he says, is a very Platonic idea. And I couldn't help thinking, as I was listening to Eleanor this morning, that there you see the real example of a manifestation of the mathematical structure which underlies all our mind, all our matter. And it is because of that order that we are able to create. If there was no order, if there were only chaos, creation would be impossible. And it is the realization that we live in an orderly world and that we are one with the consciousness that underlies that order that makes it possible for us to live creative lives.
What if you define the difference between awareness and consciousness, if there is one, and what you say about it?
Well, I would say that awareness is one aspect of consciousness.
You say it's a personal.
Not necessarily. It's not necessarily what we call the conscious in Western parlance. We constrict the conscious mind to that which would... I want to speak to that, but you say something first, Will.
Yeah. Well, I think, of course, that if you are conscious, you are aware. And I feel that we are always aware immediately that one of our great problems is that we blur this awareness so that we don't see things as they should be. And here it is, I think, that if we would look into our own natures, our own physical natures, we would see that that too, in its sensory awareness, is immediately. You see now, you taste now, you smell now, and so on. All of our senses are immediate. And if they're not, if you taste what you had for breakfast now, there's something the matter with you. This is...
You've got indigestion, obviously.
And it is this sense of immediacy that I think is so important. In other words, the only time you can do anything is now. This putting
we really agree on that,
I
don't we? Maybe we don't agree about anything else, but we agree on that. And
this, of course, is what we have to realize, that there is no enlightenment in the future. There is only enlightenment now.
I always say, you can't get nearer to God. You're either with him or without him.
That's right. It's an immediate process. There's no God, no reality out there. It's here. And this is what we have to know.
Here now. You know, this, I don't want to frustrate you in asking another question, but of course this is entirely related to the problem of self and selfhood and particulate, or individualized or individuated consciousness, if we want to put it that way. And if my memory is correct, in the Vedantic mysticism, consciousness is not ascribed to the self. The self is ascribed to consciousness. Maybe you can, Sita can correct me if I'm wrong there. But it's something in this idea that that self is a result or aspect of consciousness rather than the other way around. We're not a self and then we're conscious. It's conscious. It's because we're conscious we are a self. Do you agree? I'm right. She's nodding. Great. Yes, Renette.
Could you also, either of you, perhaps draw the distinction and or similarities between consciousness and thought or thinker, which seems to create problems for us?
I tried in the beginning, in my invocation of the metaphysical triad, to introduce the principle of creative intelligence, which, as René knows very, very well, Plato called the nous. And it seems to me that even in the Secret Doctrine, HPV equates this nous with what is known as the jivatma, the living Atma, the living conscious self, if we can put it that way, of the universe. And this is first, this divine intelligence is first. Its creative action is thought. You may say, you can, but all these metaphors, we understand, are metaphorical. If you say that the divine intelligence thinks the world, then in some ways that gives us a clue, because we understand the nature of Maya that way, as that it is an evanescence, creative emanation, if you like, a creation of the self of the world, if you want to put it in those kind of metaphoric terms. So that the thought is the power, the active power, the ongoing activity that produces what we want it to be. It's the use of eros, if you like. If you want to divide or think of the world in terms of logos and eros, and don't get me started on logos, because that's one of my hobby horses, which I can rock on for days. I so disagree with the way most theosophical writers talk about Logos. So anyway, Logos, of course, is the divine intelligence, the intelligent principle. And its active power, if you want to put it that way, is Eros, which is love, which is the binding and unitive, creative force of that divine intelligence as it reveals itself in the world. Here I am again. But it has many aspects, and intention is not the least of it, which is called in our theosophical parlance, which again I don't like, will, wisdom, activity. You know that little phrase, will, wisdom, activity. I hate the word will. Will. The word, but not the name or the person. Only its application. Now, when it's applied to a human, specific human being, it's perfect. But used in that sense, as it is in the literature, it seems to me to be a very truncated picturization of what the whole is. It's as if the consciousness intends itself. It intends itself to be. And therefore, it is. And it's this intentionality that displays itself in all of us. And of course, it's distorted in us. It exhibits itself in power complexes and egotism and in all kinds of things. But until consciousness is able to define itself, delimit itself, it can't create the world. And therefore, egotism, miserable as it is in somebody else, not so bad in me, you understand, is a necessary manifestation. It's one of the stages that we have to accept, knowing that it is only part of this ongoing movement, which is ever more inclusive, ever more aware, if you like, ever more expressive, and ever more creative, ever more unitive. So one of the things that I think we must understand in talking about selfhood, that self, of course, we know transcends the ego, that when the ego is dissolved, self remains in its purity because ego is just an illusory, our illusion of the nature of self, our inability to perceive it as it truly is. But as self begins to reveal itself more and more, then we understand truly the nature of oneness or wholeness and how the whole universe is reflected and is present, not reflected, I shouldn't say it, is truly present in each individual, how each part is really a true picture of the whole. And can really experience the whole, because it is the whole, because there is nothing, there is nowhere that is missing. It is everywhere, truly, and therefore it is in us. Therefore, the universe is a series of ones. When Schrödinger said, consciousness is a singular of which the plural is unknown, he said something which is a matter of experience. It's not a matter, it's not a conceptualization, it's not an idea. It is a fact for us. Consciousness is experienced always as one. I experience consciousness. I can attribute consciousness to you, but I can't experience your consciousness. I cannot share your grief, your thoughts, your experience. I can only perceive it and experience my own as being yours, like yours. Therefore, consciousness is one, and we are a series of wholes, all of us, wholly ourselves, wholly embracing the all. And when we talk about enlightenment, self-transcendence, this is what I think it points to the realization, the total realization of this as a state which transcends any separateness of inwardness and outwardness, which is truly the world and myself. And if one can really begin to understand that that otherness which I see out there in nature and in the world and in society, however it may distress me, however it may hurt me, however it may wound me, is still myself, my own. I don't know. Where are we?
Well, I think they're really at the central point that all metaphysical thinking, as I see it, gradually leads us to this sense that the reality manifests itself in the infinitely small and the infinitely great. That these are one expression of this totality. And it is the recognition of this that is all important. Now, I think both Emily and I have said, I feel that this is experiential. It lies always beyond thought, but thought is the creative power that constantly thrusts us towards an understanding of this in some kind of symbolic way. But from my point of view, I feel that all definitions are in a way secondary. This is the endeavor all too often to blur the thing, to fail to face up to the immediacy of our own problem, of our own experience, of our own understanding of the world, and of our relationship to all the other consciousnesses in the world. This is why I liked the quotation I read at the beginning, because I think perhaps when Emily was speaking, you felt something of that resonance which, to a metaphysical thinker, somehow stimulates, causes waves within himself, which somehow point out to this process, which I think is the process that all theosophists are really engaged in. This process of realizing that we are co-workers with nature, that this is the whole meaning of this whole phenomenal world in which we are. It's a creative process in which we are absolutely inextricably engaged. We cannot fail, I think, to recognize and do what we can in that world.
That, I think, is such a terribly important point, that we are creating the world, each of us, as consciousness presents itself in us. Consciousness through us is world creating, and we ourselves are creating the world. This, it seems to me, imposes on us the most enormous challenge and also the greatest responsibility and obligation. We, in many small ways, see what we do to the world from moment to moment and decry it. But I think we don't realize that it is in our power really to make a new world, an entirely fresh world. This is not arrogance or anthropomorphism. This is really acknowledgement of the power of the universe as it works through us. We sometimes see man as an alien in nature. We should never regard him as that. Man is not an alien, no matter how he tries to separate himself from nature, but that's the mechanism of his present consciousness. But we are never aliens in nature. We cooperate with nature, we must, and we change and transform nature. And this isn't bad, this is good in the sense of the ultimate good. This is what we must, this is what man is made to be. We must be co-creators in this sense, intelligent workers with nature. Therefore, if we don't like our society, if we don't like our world, it's up to us to change it, to make it as we wish it to be. The same thing applies, if I may say so, to the Theosophical Society. If we don't see in it an image of what we think it ought to be, whose fault is it? Can't blame it on HPB. We really can't. We have to blame it on ourselves. We are the ones who are creating it from moment to moment. Therefore, I don't think we recognize, in a sense, our power. Because if man has anything, man is the most powerful. He has the most power. Nature has, in a sense, over the millennia, been producing and evolving forms, consciousnesses, orders of being to this point when man has this self-creative power, which he can use destructively, of course, but which he will learn to use constructively. And in him, in man, it seems to me, the transformative power of consciousness has at last begun to flower, begun, I might say. Its ability, if I may say, just at the end, to create and metamorphize forms, worlds, orders of beings, from crystals and plants to animals, to self-directing animals, and to self-aware human beings like ourselves, to self-transcending saints and seers. And the occultist, the true occultist, studies and tries to understand this transformative power as it exhibits itself in him, in his own being, in his own body, in his own physical and psychophysical mechanism, his own materia mundi, if I can call it that. And then he realized that this just speck of dust, if you will, because from one point of view, that's what we are. I think it's a nice thing, the idea that we came out of the earth's clay and the clay exhibits itself in us. And realized that this speck of dust in the here and now is nothing else than a presentiment of the one, the all, which is truly the consciousness of the world. Anything else? You want to have one last word?
Oh, why should I have a last word?
It's a female's privilege.
She is always female. I've never rested that.
And she's going to get the last word or else. But the last word's with you. Please. Anybody else have something to say? Yes.
Emily, you mentioned something earlier about intention. And I wonder if you could say a bit about from whence does intention arise?
The intention arises from the very, very primary nature of consciousness, which is the fundamental datum in the world. We can ascribe nothing to the absolute oneness. It's non-being. We can't talk about it, think about it, speculate. It's silly. Why it does this or why it does that. But all we can say is that there is a will to be in the universe. Otherwise, there would be no universe. It would vanish. If there were not the intent to be, there would be non-being. And that intentionality, that intention, if you want to call it, that cosmic intention is nothing but the will to be. That's why it's called will. It's the intention to be. And that is our ultimate intention with respect to our own being. Now, how the being unfolds, how we interpret that intention in very personal and individual terms is always unique in us because it is one. Uniqueness and oneness are the same, are opposite aspects of the same reality. One and one. And therefore, the way we interpret that will to be is our own responsibility, our own creativity. And in this, I think, this is our human, our individual contribution to the all. It's the only contribution we can make.
Yeah, elaborate just a little bit on Emily's initial question and go a little bit into the nature of mind and thought compared to consciousness.
I yield happily to you.
This is what Emily has very largely spoken about. The creative aspect, the intelligence within the field of consciousness gives you that relationship of the creative, formative power which we have. It is this which forms things, and creation means the form. I think the mind must ultimately become, as it were, a shining tool for the manipulation of forms. The shining comes from the nature of consciousness, which shows itself through that. And in a certain sense, I think this is what we have to realize. This is why we are telling people, and we must realize ourselves, that we must think that there is no easy way around it. You can't get around the mathematical structure. You have to understand it. And that's what thinking is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we hear you, yes.
I think that it's very hard to relate what reality, I mean, if there is such a thing as reality, is under all the veils, because first of all, you have a realm of science which attempts to eliminate the personal judgment and find to reach through whatever is biased. And then you have the spiritual search, which attempts to eliminate what is unreal in order to find what is real. And when you say that you can make your own, that of your own consciousness, you make your own reality, or you can change the reality outside you, in what realm do you find a basis of truth on which to understand or build or construct a consciousness to either see yourself or others?
I see what you mean exactly, but I don't think that when I said that, if you're referring to anything that I said, that I attributed, that I called that reality. I think I called it the world, and I called it a lot of other things, maybe, but I don't think I ever called it reality. Reality is not hazy, if I may say so. Reality is not something out there. It may be only it's true in its absolute sense. It is beyond all thought, beyond all experience, beyond all phenomena. But nevertheless, it's in us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And yes.
What I'm trying to say is it seems to me that we're approaching it all with the mind, and the feelings have not been touched, and I feel that they are an incredibly important part of the consciousness.
Didn't you feel Emily's emotions involved in what you were saying?
It's hard not to.
No, if you are interested in thinking, you are emotionally interested in thinking too. In other words, you bring all the powers of yourself into this. I think it's this separation of thinking,
exactly.
The thoughts and feeling and all these other things are separate, which is one of the great sources of our error. You cannot, but if you're using feeling in a separate thing as somehow you can, by feeling, reach reality, then I think you're deluding yourself. You have to be able to realize the structure of things. And this, from my point of view, is always achieved by thought, by intelligence. Remember, if we want to look at this slightly differently from the way Emily and I have been talking about it, the description of buddhi, which of course is part of prakriti, if you want to go into the Eastern point of view, is always defined as intelligence or as pure reason. We have tended to call it love, but this is because this has been misleading, because we think of love in an emotional way. But really, to love, you have to be intelligent. This is why you see so many disturbances in the world, because what they think is love is certainly not intelligent.
Absolutely. I just want to say one thing about this. We aspire to know. This is really, or a good thing, if you like. We aspire to know. That is what man is. But there are many modes of knowing. And we must never deny or denigrate any of these modes, because each one of them is a point of entry into the real, if you like to put it that way. Our ways of understanding are myriad, but they are all valid. And if for you to feel something is truly to know something, more power to you. If someone else, however, needs to explore another mode, that is his way. And in the long run, you understand, all these modes are one mode. They are all, as Will said, just facets of that universal consciousness which is all-enveloping, which is like the circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere, so that we cannot say that this is this way and that's that way. They are all matters of interaction and relationship and perception, and they are all absolutely necessary because they are all natural to man. All of them are natural of nature. Yes, Renee.
Maybe to turn on to Wayne's question, I have in a way the same question. I think what may not have emerged altogether clearly is, in what ways, and could you each give examples, in what ways is consciousness, our consciousness, world-creating, given that the realm of science, the realm of the stars and all that seems fairly fixed? That may have been your question, right? And so where do we, in specific ways, have the power to create?
I guess perhaps I should define what I mean by world. When I say world, I mean that interaction of man and nature, because that's what a world is. I don't mean nature itself, which is the product of universal consciousness, the universal creative consciousness, and certainly the divine ideas exhibit themselves most dramatically, most explicitly in the laws of nature, in the exquisite forms and orders of nature. It's everywhere there for us to look at. We cannot be but consumed with wonder and with awe when we see all around us the products of this creative and formative power of the universal intelligence, the archetypes, if you like, in the archetypal world. But when I talk about the world, I talk about man's world, man's interaction with nature. And in this sense, I may be talking about it in the sense of which people like, thinkers like Gebser have talked about it. Man is world-creating, he creates his world. And I like to talk, and I would like to, happy to talk for hours, on the subject of what do we mean by races. This is what these are worlds, modes of consciousness which exhibit themselves as races, as orders, as societies. And that's how I meant the world, the word, the word world, I'm sorry. Does that help at all? Does that help?
Whoops.
Yes, there are lots of people.
Can you each very, very briefly speak to the statement that Will made, to love, you have to be intelligent? Would you each elaborate on
that? You can elaborate first.
Well, you see, I think in order to really care for anything, you must be intelligent enough to see that thing, that person,
that idea as it really is, to accept it as it is, and to relate to it as it is. And this is the total process of intelligence, as I see it. And this is the only real relationship which is meaningful, as far as I can see, in terms of our human experience.
I'll answer, if I may, by two quotations, in the proper order. First from the Buddha, then from Fritz Kunz. The Buddha said, love is the enlightenment of the mind. Now, what did he mean by that? He meant that love is much more than emotion, you see. We think of love as being feeling. This isn't love. As I said, I could talk about love all day. But that's not important. The important thing is feel love for a minute, not talk about it all day. Fritz also said, you cannot do the good until you know the good. And I think that's one of the most wonderful things that he ever said. And he said a lot of very splendid things. The whole idea is that love is a power. It's a unitive power in the universe which operates at all levels. We may perceive it as an emotion. We may feel it as an emotion, which you understand is unitive. But on the very physical level, it exhibits itself as the most powerful of all procreative energies, sexual love, if you like, sexual desire. In the emotional level, it is that unitive feeling which draws us together. At the level of the mind, it is the power of synthetic, unitive, inspirational thought that makes us perceive wholes, always wholes, wholes. It brings things together. And at the highest level, it is that power which sends us forth and gives us to the world. You understand it is a gesture of the self. I give myself to the world. I make that ultimate sacrifice of embedding myself, imprisoning myself in matter, if you like. Because if one is a free spirit, a free intelligence, well, just think how great it might be. You know, we might imagine. All of us have made that sacrifice. We have made that commitment intentionally to give ourselves to the world. The ultimate act of sacrifice, which is spoken about in all the great religions, perhaps symbolically and metaphorically, but it is a gesture that every one of us has made, and that is the greatest act of love.
Well, our time is going on.
Our president says we have to shut up.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the same thing, and I was going to quote HPV, who says that time is an illusion, but we're very much concerned in that illusion.